Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a podcast where we deep dive into the writing of your favorite novels.
This season, we're exploring Sarah J. Maas's first installment in the Crescent City series. This is Jack.
And I'm Amy. This is part two of this week's episode.
The views expressed by the hosts are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author.
This podcast is a discussion, shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
The interpretations presented in this podcast are just a few of the many possibilities. Listeners are encouraged to read along and share their own analysis of the text.
Though the hosts speak mostly within the constraints of this book, series and extended universe spoilers may be discussed with or without warning.
Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, depression, self-harm, and death will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
We get some breadcrumbs in the narrative when Bryce starts to allude to the time that she and Danica were in a motorcycle accident and were threatened by a bunch of men while still in college. We learn the full story in dribs and drabs throughout the novel, which is a writing technique some authors use, and I think SJM does well with this story.
Yeah, I'm curious to see if I have a different opinion. I feel like the payoff wasn't enough for me.
Okay.
This is me prior to analyzing the whole book.
Yeah.
Let's circle back later.
But for now, let's just acknowledge that It's happening. It's starting now. Motorcycle accident story starts now.
Close your eyes, Danica.
What I think is important about it in this moment is that it reminds us how resistant Bryce is to remembering things. Her narrative is extremely filtered right now. She's not capable of accessing those memories purely because she's just got a wall up. Also, by trying to remember, she thinks, quote, a hole tore open in her chest, gaping and howling. And the first thing that came to my mind was, oh, there's room for Hunt. He can go fill that hole.
Woo. Look, I didn't make a dirty joke.
Good job.
Thank you.
I didn't even think about the possibility of a dirty joke.
He went to go fill her hole.
No, I know. It was because you said you didn't make a joke that now I realize it could have been dirty.
But none of us made it, so we're okay.
Yeah. And then just some last thoughts in this chapter. Of course, the happy memory Bryce has before Danica's death is the tattoo. Because, of course, it's the tattoo. Because the tattoo is significant. That's just SJ. I don't think that's actually a happy memory.
No.
Because she was complaining about it.
Yeah.
Obviously, she's looking at it through rose-tinted glasses. And SJM wants to remind us of the tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just love that the two, Bryce and Hunt, are two peas in a pod making Rune Dannon's life hell.
I want to be part of this friend group so bad.
I know you do. Sounds like something you'd be really good at.
I would thrive with this group.
Yes, you would.
I thrive with our group. But they'd be my other friend group.
Yeah.
Our other friend group.
Yeah, because I would be there too.
Hell yeah.
In chapter 21, we start from Rune's perspective in Luna's temple. I have a lot of thoughts about Luna and her appearance in the temple, but I left them in the breadcrumbs, so we shall move on.
So we get to the origin of Luna, and therefore Lunathian, right? Which is where they're at. And we have Luna with the twin wolves at her feet. And this immediately reminds me of the origin of Rome. You know, there's that lore, mythology of Rome being founded by Romulus and Remus, who were both raised by a wolf. Mm-hmm. And the image that you'll have that, if you look up like Romulus and Remus, you'll see a female wolf. And they're both babies are like sucking at the teat of the wolf. And this is such a gender flip.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have two wolves at the feet of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, is this cool or is it meant to be more? I don't know. We'll figure that out.
Yeah, I guess wait for further in the breadcrumbs and later in the season once we've read Crescent City 3.
Yeah. And it's also just like, there's nothing to analyze here. It's just cute when like Bryce links her arms up with Hunt and then she's, you know, because Rune's like, what the hell are you doing here? And she's like, we're the best friends. We're best friends. We go everywhere together. And Hunt's grinning, the best.
It is really cute. And it's just a reminder that they have the same sense of humor.
Yep.
Like
he'll play along with it.
Oh yeah. If it benefits him, aka he can piss off Rune.
Yeah.
And she can piss off Rune, they're gonna piss off Rune.
They're gonna piss off Rune.
Before Hunt and Bryce show up, Rune is, you know, in a dark corner with his shadows staying hidden, but he sees tourists go through the temple and he thinks of the tourists as a flock of ducklings, which to me obviously means they're weak, they need protecting. Hence, you know, that makes sense because of his role as the leader of the Fae Ox. We see this again from his point of view, but it's related to Bryce. The tour guide at one point tells the tourists they can go into, quote, the chamber where the stag sacrifices are prepared to be burned in Luna's honor. Later down that very same page, quote, Bryce went wholly still, the stillness of the Fae, like a stag halting in a wood. Why would SJM use a stag reference on the same page in two different locations if not to tie them together?
Yep. It's just too close for writing. And I was like, okay, well, Bryce is the stag and she sacrifices herself for the whole city.
Yep. You're absolutely correct.
Yep.
Good job, because I didn't even make that connection.
Oh, yeah.
Good job.
Thank you.
We have more references to lore that I feel necessary to point out. The priestesses of Luna's temple are a reference to the Mother Maiden and Crone, or the triple goddess in neo-paganism. It's a common trope in literature, and SJM has used it in other works as well. The Mother, Maiden, and Crone symbolizes separate stages in the female life cycle, as well as phases of the moon. They are often also depicted as ruling one of the realms of the heavens, earth, and underworld. Just want to put that out there. And that's all I'm going to say. I also wanted to make a note that there's visual representation of the Oracle's temple and Luna's temple from Hunt's point of view, and Hunt acknowledges that the Oracle's temple is a domed onyx building while Luna's temple is white stoned. And I think that that might be significant.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so Luna is white,
mm-hmm.
Oracle is dark. And again, going back to my Bryce is Luna
yeah.
concept, her power is light,
mm-hmm.
so light that it blinded
mm-hmm.
the Oracle.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're blind, you don't see anything.
Oh,
so it's dark.
That's a great point. I was thinking, you know, are Luna and the Oracle yin and yang? Is
yeah,
Luna good, Oracle evil? But absolutely, you're right. Blinding light, blind Oracle.
But that's like, you know, only if my Luna Bryce connection theory works. So we'll just keep going until otherwise.
I'm convinced thus far.
So I want to look at the same section, but through my feminist lens. And so Hunt sees this 12-year-old girl, the Athelite, mm-hmm. who is sweeping. And I'm going to do a long quote here, but it's important. Quote, a waxing moon until she became a full-fledged priestess upon reaching maturity, when she would trade the crescent for the full circle of Luna. And whenever her immortal body began to age and fade, her cycle vanishing with it, she would again trade the charm. The priestesses all had their own reasons for offering themselves to Luna, for forsaking their lives and embracing the goddess's eternal maidenhood. Just as Luna had no mate or lover, so they would live. All right. All this came from looking at a 12-year-old.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think that this is Hunt being pervy. Like, yeah. I want to, like, emphasize that. It's not like he's looking at this 12-year-old and is like, ah, like, you're never going to have sex, little child.
Right.
Rather, I think it's meant to show that this child has no choice.
Mm.
Because he says, I don't know why some, you know, people some of the women choose this. Well, she's 12. What choice does she have in right. this? So how many other women are also forced into this servitude?
Right.
And I think that, you know, whether he's consciously calling that out, there's a contradiction of like, hey, child, some of these women want this. And it's like, no, that's not true. Maybe one, maybe a few.
Well, I think also it's possible that even if the child made the choice, it's not a fully informed choice.
Right.
How can you allow a child to decide, yeah, I'm not going to have sex the rest of my life?
And then allowing them to go and sign up for like this temple. Like, like that's not a choice. That's, you know, there's some kind of
coercion
happening there. And then, like, keep in mind that Luna is who this city is founded on. It's Lunathian. Crescent City, you know, like mm-hmm. it all comes back down to Luna. And, you know, she's related to the Fae and the wolves. but she's also virginal. And I'm wondering if that's like part of why Bryce is so shunned, because she's so not, you know, she's so sexual, which is hilarious because, you know, the Vanir are also hypersexual too. Like, it's not like she is walking around being the only one having sex. But at the end of the day, women's cycles, their menstruation, it determines time and growth. And it's just women. We don't have that at this point in this city or in our world, like any kind of measurement with men either.
Right.
And then it's just like, you know, we had Luna being very similar to the founder of Rome. Now we're seeing her being very similar to Artemis.
Right.
The huntress, the virginal huntress.
Yeah. Who's often associated with the moon.
Yeah.
It's all very intentional on SJM's part. I just want to know
why
the significance.
Yes.
At this point in the scene, Hunt calls Justinian because he needs help searching for some information. We learn from Hunt's point of view that Justinian potentially has no hope for freedom. Quote, Justinian bore the halo as well, and Micah had never shown much interest in him beyond his popularity with the grunt troops of the 33rd. If there was any sort of deal to earn his freedom, Justinian had never said a word. Now, I bring this up in the breadcrumbs, but there are so few breadcrumbs about the twist that happens partway through this book that I felt the need to call it out. Of like, okay, so we have some understanding of Justinian's motivation for potentially going against Micah in the future. It's the only time we get any information, to the best of my knowledge. So just going to point it out there for all of us. This is the moment, I think Jack has previously mentioned, where Justinian makes a comment about Bryce's good looks. Hunt tries to end the conversation, but Justinian responds, quote, no one gets a medal for suffering the most, you know. In this case, Justinian is talking about Hunt not having a partner since Shahar. And
go ahead. I have such a point to make, but continue.
All I want to say before we get to Jack is it's important that this information is happening now, since we've just learned Bryce is punishing herself a couple chapters ago. We're learning Hunt is punishing himself, and the two are so alike.
Now, how does Hunt punish Bryce in the next couple chapters once she discovers that they held that they had the truth of Micah was the victim the whole time? He tells her, do you want a fucking medal or parade? Amy Gass, that was part of my checklist. My vision board. But it's, to me, it's like, holy crap, no one gets a medal for suffering the most, you know. And then he goes and tells Bryce, do you want a fucking medal or a parade?
Right after he learns about how she's been punishing herself about not knowing who the angel was that she saved. Wow.
Yep.
Wow.
They are the same character.
Well, but also, like, it's really cruel of Hunt to be, like, lashing out at Bryce because he got it dished out to him by someone else.
I mean, to me, that also shows, like, one, we knew whatever Justinian was saying is, like, really hitting home.
Yeah.
I think that parallel shows just how close to home it hit.
Yeah.
Because he's off-kiltered now.
Yeah. Yep. 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 Great point.
Thank you. So going into chapter 22, Bryce is starting to change her mind about Hunt, even if she doesn't know it. Quote, Bryce waited until Hunt's muscled back and beautiful wings had disappeared. Like, all right. Like, the language is changing. It's so subtle. This is why SJM is good, because there's no immediate, like, I think I like him.
Right.
It's just the language, the description is changing slowly.
Yep. That's right. I do have a question, though. Why does... And this is unrelated to Hunt, so hard left. But why does Bryce force the Chosen One title on Rune when they're talking alone together? Is it a way to punish Rune? Is it a way to punish herself? Is it a way to deny her true abilities? It felt so lashing out. It just felt so immature.
Yeah. My answer to that is that immediately after she refers to herself as a half-breed slut. Mm. So I think it's like combining the two. Well, aren't you the chosen one? I'm just a half-breed slut.
Yeah.
And she's using his own words against him. And it's a reminder that she's the illegitimate child. Mm-hmm. She's the half-breed. And she's the quote-unquote slut, like he called her.
Right.
I think that it is a punishment. but the punishment is served best when immediately reminding Rune what he called her.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point of, like, I'm going to insult you, but with nice words.
Yeah. And here are the words that you gave me. Yeah. So it's like, I'm giving you your actual title, which is being a chosen one. You're a prince. You're special. Mm-hmm. Now I'm going to repeat the words you said to me.
Half-breed slut.
Mm-hmm.
Which is just so wrong.
She was 17, right?
16, yeah.
Oh my God. The men in this book.
And he was, mind you, like almost 60 years older than her.
Yeah. You know what? No one has the audacity like the men in this book.
Seriously. So you alluded to the fact that Rune previously has called Bryce a half-breed slut. And we're seeing in this moment how that bad opinion, false perception, or just like mean words really hurt Bryce. So it's not only her rejection that her father presented to her when she, even though she learned the old language of the Fae, now it's Rune showing that even he's capable of rejecting her. Mm-hmm. And no wonder why she tries so hard to avoid the opinions of others and not caring about the opinions of others. She's been burned by her father. She's been burned by her brother. Why even try?
There's no point. There's no point to try with anyone. And then she's been burned by Connor's brother.
Oh, Ethan.
Ethan. Yeah. You know, like everyone just done her dirty.
Yeah.
The only person who hasn't burned her, a literal flame.
Lava. As far as we know.
As far as we know. So, like, this world is just, you know, for as much as the men love to shit on the women in this world, or maybe just Bryce, the men are so fixated mm-hmm. on the women. Mm-hmm. Like, even we get in, like, towards the end of this chapter, we get a mention of the statue of the two gods together, and it's Solas burying his face into Kathona's breasts, and, like, they're described as, like, mountain breasts,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's just, like, everything about this world is like, you're so obsessed with women.
Yeah.
Be nicer. You have a theory about this statue though, right?
I do. It's in the breadcrumbs.
Oh, okay. We'll wait for that then.
From there, we're going to move on into chapter 23. Jessica calls Bryce while she's at the gallery and asks for something. And when Bryce doesn't snap to it right away, Jessica threatens to turn Bryce into a variety of insects. Bryce, however, suggests, what about a dragonfly? I'd love to be a dragonfly. And I love this because my mother loves dragonflies. So I know, but wonder, do you know that dragonflies are symbolic for transformation and adaptability? It feels intentional here for Bryce and the journey that she's about to embark on. She is about to transform. She is about to adapt. So just wanted to point that symbolism out.
Be a dragonfly.
Be a dragonfly.
I thought she was just doing a Silence of the Lambs reference.
There's no dragonflies in Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, there is, where he has the dragonfly. Like, he collects dragonflies.
Oh, he collects moths.
Oh, yeah. Well.
You tried.
They're basically dragonflies.
Sure, they have wings.
They have wings and they're gross.
Fair.
Fight me on them. So I want to talk about the Rifle Godslayer, which other than the most obvious...
Obvious
name for the rifle. It's the rifle that Bryce uses to kill Micah. And the rifle is described as radiating from gold and steel. And it reminds me of Luna's statue. So I'm going to go back to a quote when we were at Luna's statue. Quote, "The quiver, of course, is real gold, and arrows pure silver with tips of diamond." Just like the Godslayer, which is gold and silver.
Mm-hmm.
And like the arrows being tipped with diamonds. You know, the bullets of this rifle are also fancy. They have the engraving of Memento Mori. And it just kind of reminds me of those diamond tipped arrows where there's just a little something to them, you know, make it a little extra spicy and to make a statement. And while Memento Mori is often associated with skulls and like, you know, hardcore goth, diamonds are associated with purity. So I just felt like there's like an interesting contradiction between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I love it.
Thank you.
Hunt gets a call while Bryce is at the gallery that there's been another murder. So he forces Bryce to go with him to that scene of the murder by the Cristallos. We see Bryce's response to her past trauma associated with Danica's death in this moment. She starts to panic. She starts to shake. She can't keep her head clear. And despite the fact that Hunt insists he told Bryce what to expect at the scene, Bryce knows she tuned him out and, quote, was as dazed as if she'd snorted a heap of light seeker, which, by the way, is what she had done the night of Danica's death. So we can assume at this point that Bryce is basically reliving the night of Danica's death. She feels like she snorted light seeker. All she can think about is Danica and the pack of devils. Like, she is not in a good place.
Yeah, and then, like, to top it all off, Hunt and Rune are talking about Bryce while she's right there. Granted, she's, like, you know, having a moment, but, like, talk to her. And then Hunt says to Rune, quote, she's a grown woman. She doesn't need you to decide what she can handle. Fuck you, man. You're just, like, he is being such a boy right now. And in the next chapter, like, he just can't back down of being wrong.
Right, because what he did was wrong. Mm-hmm. Just because he has to see this kind of crap every day doesn't mean Bryce has to or is accustomed to it.
Yeah.
So just admit that maybe you shouldn't have brought a civilian to the scene of a murder.
Who has extreme trauma.
Yeah.
And the way that he kind of makes it sound is like he did it on purpose to see how she would react.
Yeah. And he's trying to make it sound like he's noble. Mm-hmm. By letting her make her own decisions. But he didn't let her make the decision. He told her to come.
Yeah.
When she tried to get out of it.
No, it's like it's fake feminism. It's fake, like, she's in charge of herself.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Hunt, you are lucky that I'm willing to forgive you.
I was going
to
say, you're lucky that your dick is thick.
I don't know. We don't know that yet.
If the Hobbit can't wrap her arms around it.
What if she's got the smallest little arms and it means nothing?
We don't know. She can sit on his finger.
She's got a 6-foot wingspan.
Yeah, so she can't wrap her 6-foot hands. I mean, he's girthy then, right?
Foot? I'm inches.
Six inches, sorry.
I knew what I was doing. I knew I was making that joke, and then you kept going. I was like, I should inform you.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Oh, man. We're reminded again that Bryce is punishing herself. Previously, there were only hints of no dancing, but now we learn the extent to which the dancing has stopped. Quote, once Bryce might have gone right to the dance studio and moved until the world made sense again. It had been 2 years since she'd set foot in a studio. She'd thrown out all her dance clothes and shoes. It's just sad.
It's sad. When Hunt asks Bryce how she survived the attack, she says, I didn't survive. I got away. And I feel like there's so much to that. Bryce views herself as having not survived that night. Yes, she's alive, but she didn't survive. So I was trying to come up with, and, like, you know, we talk about, like, ACOTAR a lot, and with Pharaoh, we talk about surviving, not thriving.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's like, I was trying to come up with, I'm like, she's aliving, not surviving. But, like, she's alive, didn't survive.
Right. And to me, that quote always implied, like, I didn't survive because it didn't attack me. I went after it. It got away from me.
Yeah. That's what she's saying. But I'm like, it just felt so much deeper than that. She hasn't even been surviving these years.
Yeah.
She's just alive.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. And that's the point where we learn that Bryce saved Micah from the Cristallos. Now, why didn't Bryce know this before, we're all asking? Well, in chapter 24, Hunt explains that the illusion of power was important to maintain for Micah's sake. Quote, for his sake, if word got out that the governor had his ass handed to him, it wouldn't have looked good. Bryce says, especially when he was saved by a half-breed.
It's such a, like, the dynamics, the power, you don't want to look bad, it doesn't want to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, and Hunt makes a really big point, like, no one called you that.
Yeah.
But yes, that is the answer. Like,
it is.
You know, like, you know, we did not use a bad word, but we do agree with the sentiment. And as a words of affirmation person, I'm going to come back to that moment when, you know, she's explaining, why didn't anyone tell me? Like, do you want a medal or something? A parade? Like, that hurts my feelings.
Yeah, that's so hurtful. The fact that Bryce is willing to reveal the extent to which she searched for the angel reveals her true nature and her true heart, despite Hunt belittling her right now. Quote, why not tell me, though? I looked in all the hospitals just to see if he'd made it. More than that, actually, she demanded answers about how the warrior was recovering. What I wanted was to know that something I did made a difference that night. And I don't know if Hunt is moved by it, but it does feel important that he learns this about her, that she cares and she wants to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
However, being on Hunt's suspect list, which we were reminded about earlier in the episode, is the last straw for Bryce. To me, in my mind, being doubted and viewed as not good enough or being a suspect for murders repeats the trauma of being rejected by the Autumn King and Rune. Bryce is working her ass off, doing all that she can to help Hunt figure out this murder case and figure out who killed Danica. And yet somehow she is still a suspect despite all of her work. And it's like being rejected all over again. She just relived her rejection from her brother when they talked at Luna's temple. So she's feeling really, really vulnerable right now. It makes sense that she's going to lash out at Hunt when he suspects her.
Yeah, I mean, and Hunt just can't stop saying the wrong thing.
Yeah, he's a little bit of a mess.
I think this is the moment he realizes, like, have I just not talked to another human or like another person in a really long time?
Yeah, do I even know how to use words?
This is bad. And I love how it ends. Bryce is the one who banishes Hunt. She sends him away, telling him to, quote, get the fuck out of my sight. Hunt even spreads his wings, like trying to intimidate her, and she refuses to step back. She is absolutely in the right. Mm-hmm. She knows it. And Hunt is the one who has to tuck tail and leave, or spread tail, spread feathers and leave. Bryce continues to have control over the situation and over Hunt. She has the power. Mm-hmm. And I think Hunt recognizes that. That's my personal thought, is like in this moment, he's like, okay, fine, I'm leaving, but not because you asked me to, but because I want to type of energy. And then I just want to end on my note for this chapter is that I'm not entirely convinced SJM has ever run a day in her life, because she has Bryce running with flats. And she's not wearing a sports bra. What is this?
Yeah. That, like, sounds like pain.
And she's got big old boobies.
Sounds like pain.
So, nope. Not happening.
I have to bring it back to the fact that Bryce is punishing herself. Not only is she running on flats with no sports bra, punishing herself. She's also punishing herself by looking at the text messages with Connor, with her friends, looking at the picture of the pack of devils, and remembering the time Danica first said, I love you, to Bryce. And she's in a bad place. And we know that because she's been trying to access these memories, because she's been rejected again. However, is the memory relevant here? Does it feel like it belongs?
I don't know. The memory's always kind of felt off to me. But that could be because, again, I'm not entirely convinced of the payout. But I can be. Like, I'm willing to be sold on this.
Okay. So maybe we'll put a pin in it and circle back sometime.
Yeah.
If we remember.
Agreed. So let's get into some safe breadcrumbs. These are non-multiverse related. In chapter 18, quote, rumor claimed that the entire base of the Asteres Crystal Palace as a slab of salt, that it had been built atop a natural deposit. Just putting this here in case it comes back later.
I think it will. Also in chapter 18, quote, the lowest level purebred demon fresh out of hell could bring an entire city to a standstill as it went on a rampage, which is basically the last 25% of the book, except it's more than one.
Yep. In chapter 19, quote, it's a good time for business when key players converge for the summit. So many ruling class elites, all with their own interests. Is this potentially alluding to the fact that the Viper Queen is selling synth and will sell it to Hunt and other members of the Traari?
I was just pulling at straws, man. I'm looking for all the clues because I'm always...
Look for all the clues. Especially since the Hunt selling and betraying part, the Hunt betrayal...
is so off-putting.
I was like, where are the clues?
Yeah.
So I'm all for searching for them.
In chapter 19, the Viper Queen says to Bryce, Danica was a threat to me, and in more ways than perhaps you know. So the obvious answer is that the Viper Queen is referring to Synth that she deals and that Danica was looking into. But I also think Danica knows more about the Viper Queen's origins and may have been looking into the Viper Queen's true identity. I'm just blowing smoke out of my ass. Maybe we'll learn more in Crescent City 3.
Still in chapter 19, quote, "Us SERPs can taste when shit is about to go down. Like a charge in the air, I can taste it now, all over this city. A lot is about to change since the Archangel will be killed and the city invaded by demons by the end of the novel."
In chapter 19, Jack referred to this earlier. When the Viper Queen tells Bryce she could sell her body, Hunt's hand was warm on her shoulder. She's not for sale. He's getting possessive because they're mates.
We love a good mate possessiveness. Still in chapter 19, quote, "Everyone, General, is for sale. You just have to figure out the asking price. Give me a day or two, Athalar, and I'll figure out yours." Is this supposed to be foreshadowing the Synth deal gone wrong? I'm going to say yes, though not a lot of confidence in this. But you know what? I'm still going to say yes.
Still going to say it. Chapter 19. "Don't underestimate the obsidian salt, Quinlan. It can bring over the very worst of hell. Like a prince of hell."
Yeah, yeah. Also, chapter 19, when Hunt tells Bryce that driving a scooter is dangerous before the drop and that Bryce should take the bus, Bryce lets out a barking laugh. There's some small clues that give her dog or wolf-like qualities, potentially foreshadowing the Prime calling her a wolf at the end of the novel. Just like Luna and the two wolves.
Ah, good point. If she's Luna, yeah. Good point. In chapter 20, when Bryce calls Hunt to ask for his help, he is instantly in protective mode. Quote, "Before his words finished sounding, a fist banged on the door. She knew it was him without pulling up the camera feed." Because they are mates and they are connected.
When Hunt admits he was sold to Micah for 85 million gold marks, Lahaba tells him Bryce bought Syrinx freedom for 23,000 gold marks. Quote, "Hunt dropped into his seat, his wings brushing her arm, softer than velvet. Smoother than silk. He snapped it tight at the touch. Why? Because the warlord wanted to hunt and break him until he was a fighting beast. And Syrinx is my friend. I was sick of losing friends." This is exactly what happens to Hunt when Sandriel buys him from Micah later in the novel, and Bryce tries to buy his freedom. Also, I feel like the wing touch thing is very similar to Pharah and Rhys in the, you know, Mist and Fury moment. You know, a good wing touch is always good.
It's always erotic. Also, I just realized Syrinx was bought for 233,000 gold marks. Who's 233 years old?
Holy shit.
Hunt.
Holy shit.
Holy fuck. It was like a direct correlation.
Oh my God.
Damn it. SJM.
That was good. I mean, like, how much more proof do we want that Syrinx is Hunt?
Right. Exactly. Still in chapter 20, when Bryce mentions not working for creeps who found her appetizing, Hunt's eyes darkened and she made herself ignore the rage she beheld there on her behalf. Mates?
Yep. Chapter 21, when Bryce sees the Crystallos demon for the first time in a book, Rune found in the Fae archives, Bryce rubs her thighs absently. Always there to remind us of the wound, which will come in handy and combat the effects of the Crystallos later.
In chapter 21, even my father might have forgotten the horn's importance until it was stolen, and he'd gotten it into his head that it would be a rallying symbol of power during a possible war. I bet Bryce will become that rallying symbol in the horn's place because she has the horn in her back.
Also in chapter 21, quote, "You think the victim somehow had contact with the horn and it brought the Crystallos right to them?" Yes, yes, that is exactly what we think.
In chapter 21, quote, "I might have some sort of preternatural gift to find the horn. When I was browsing the archives last night, this book jumped out at me. It felt like it shimmered." And yet he cannot recall that Bryce looked like she shimmered with stars not that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Bryce's eyes are literally glittering a paragraph later.
Yep. Yes. Right? She is the horn. Yeah. Oh, my God. Chapter 23. Quote, "The Godslayer rifle, gleaming as fresh as it had the day it had been forged. It unnerved Bryce that it was here, despite the fact that Jespa had split it into four pieces, mounted like a work of art behind the desk. Four pieces that could still be easily assembled. 6-inch engraved gold bullets was in the safe beside the painting on the wall. Important facts to know, since this is how Bryce will kill Micah. Feels like Jessica showed Bryce where the bullet was in case of an opportunity like that ever came around.
In chapter 24, quote, Bryce blinked, the shimmering memory replaced by the photo still glaring from her screen. Bryce remembers the moment she used starlight to blind the men who caught her and Danica, after which the memory shimmers. Feels like a breadcrumb about Bryce's starborn status.
Now let's get into some multiverse thoughts and breadcrumbs in chapter 18. In the meat market, Bryce interacts with an owl-faced female who had a spread of scrolls and books. Reminds me of Maeve because of the owl shifter association. Seems relevant since I think the Viper Queen is Valg, given that she is able to control others through her venom. Note, Bryce tells Hunt, quote, the books are a story for another time, which we never hear about. I wonder if it's for Jessica's library, but it also makes me think about Throne of Glass.
Still in chapter 18, quote, hell was severed from them by time and space. What does this mean? Does that apply to the other worlds like Prithian and the Throne of Glass universe? Does time operate differently in those worlds? Just trying to point out things that might come back later.
Yep. In chapter 18, the satyr rushed to the back, hooves thumping on the worn floors, and procured a wrapped bundle a moment later. It reeked of mold and dirt. What else reeks of mold and dirt? Reapers and Valg.
In chapter 18, quote, the tall moon-skinned woman was dressed in a gold jumpsuit, emerald hoop earrings hanging lower than her chin-length black bob. Her full lips were painted in purple so dark it was nearly black, and her remarkable green eyes marbled with veins of jade and gold. Honestly, the Viper Queen sounds like Amarin to me.
Mm-hmm. Also in chapter 18, the Viper Queen's serpentine shifter form was, quote, was a moon-white cobra with scales that gleamed like opals, whose power was rumored to be different. Something extra that mixed with her venom. Something strange and old. Like a Valg.
Like a Valg. In chapter 19, Luna is significant, and I cannot figure out why Bryce, Jack thinks Luna represents Bryce, or Bryce represents Luna. She appears everywhere in the city, and the city's named after her, but in my mind, she could be Maeve from Throne of Glass, the mother, or maybe Queen Thea or one of her daughters. I'm going to stick with the Maeve theory for now. Like Luna, Maeve has two twin wolves serve her, Fenris and Connell Moonbeam. Luna's statue is made of a moonstone dress with a tiara of moons and crescent moons. So there's a lot of correlation to Fenris, Connell, Moonbeam, and Maeve. If Luna is Maeve, then the rest of the gods are also Valg. But it doesn't make sense because I think there are more females than males. But you know what? I just had to throw it out there.
Yep.
Luna might be Valg.
Yep. In chapter 19, quote, both wolves and Fae claimed Luna as their patron goddess because the shifter and Fae are all Fae.
In chapter 20, the timing of the founding of Lunathian 500 years ago matches the war in Prithian against Hybern when the humans fought for freedom from slavery. Coincidence? I'm not sure that it is.
In chapter 20, quote, Rune tried not to remember how delighted Bryce once been whenever he demonstrated how his shadows in starlight worked, both halves of his power working as one. Sounds like when Rhys put Farah in a shadow bubble and showed her the stars during a training session early in Mist and Fury. Does that mean Rhys is starborn? Would make sense since they look alike, maybe from the same family line. We will find out so soon. Anyone listening to this already knows the answer.
We're so close. Still in chapter 20, another reason I think Luna could be Maeve, quote, the chamber where the stag sacrifices are prepared to be burned in Luna's honor. Stags make me think of Aelin and Brennan. Wouldn't Maeve love to have Aelin and her ancestors burned as sacrifices in her honor?
And finally in chapter 20, the emblem of the Starborn is an 8-point star. Nesta has an 8-point star tattoo, the tattoo that was created when she bargained with Cassian in Silver Flames. Also, Farah has a star in the middle of her back, a tattoo from a bargain she receives in Wings and Ruin. And this week's Bryceism, ask for help when you need it. Be an adult.
Be an adult. So, Jacqueline?
Mm-hmm.
Our question...
Mm-hmm.
Is this the beginning of Bryce's and Hunt's love story? And if so, what has triggered it?
It's the beginning of their lust story.
Lust story, that's true.
You know, I think first comes lust, then comes love for these two.
Okay.
I mean, their sense of humors are merging,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that that's starting to make them like one another a little bit more of like, oh, you're actually funny.
Yeah.
I mean, and we're getting a lot of physical attraction. Right. And it's hard when two hot people are in the same room like that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they're just spending a lot of time with each other. They're both hot. And then it's the fact that they're mates. They're going to have that pull. They cannot help it.
Yeah.
It's, I think that they're, no matter what, since they are true mates, there was nothing that they could have done to actually hate each other.
I'm glad they tried. I'm glad SJM tried.
She tried. She tried to make them enemies first. But, like, you know, like, they're both snotty with one another. And Hunt definitely hasn't won her over, nor should he. He has a lot of apologies to do. But it definitely starts with, I think, humor and with physical attraction. And again, this makes it the most realistic book of what, you know, like, some, you know, in her other books, mates are this, like, you just instantly fall in love and you're amazing. Like, this is the first time that, like, a relationship is being built upon a natural way. I know that's what she tried to do with Reese and Farrah, but that's not the case because Reese was in love with her before he even saw her.
Right.
So this is an organic, real way to me.
I agree. And I think what I would add to your list is that Bryce is willing to be vulnerable, which up until this point, she has not been willing to do in front of Hunt. And I think that vulnerability is what allows the next, you know, despite the annoyances between the two and despite the physical attraction, I think that vulnerability is what allows things to move forward.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to me, it reminds me of Feyre and Tamlin, that it was true vulnerability upon which they were able to build a relationship. And that's, despite how wrong Tamlin and Feyre were for each other, they had commonalities. And I think we're seeing the same thing here with Bryce and Hunt.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and, you know, Bryce has been in charge of this entire dynamic. And she set the pace by being vulnerable.
Yeah.
And we'll eventually see that from Hunt as well. But yeah, this is definitely the beginning. We're seeing the little sprinkles.
Yeah. And I like what you said, that Bryce is setting the pace. She is the one who sets the pace for every moment of progression in their relationship.
Even with sex and everything, in like the second book. Yeah.
But even the more emotional parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
The picture taking.
Yep.
And some other moments. But
she's like, this is what's happening. You're going to be on board now. Thank you.
Yep, that's exactly right.
That's how I need a date. That's what I do with my friends. Why don't I just do that with guys?
Exactly. That can be your bracism for another week.
Right? I'll save that for next week. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform. Next week, we'll be exploring chapters 25 through 30 of A House of Earth and Blood.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com for a chance to have your feedback discussed during a future mini episode.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please visit our website, booktalkforbooktalk.com, to view our latest merch and learn about supporting the show through Patreon, Ko-Fi, or Venmo. You can also follow us on TikTok or Instagram at the handle Book Talk for Book Talk.
Bye.